Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and the well-being of our food, water, air, and earth, the well-being of our communities, the well-being of our society, and the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. Every week on the show, we bring on different experts, scientists, thought leaders, authors, advocates, filmmakers, organizers, journalists, and a whole bunch of different people who connect the dots between different facets of what's going on in our world and our impact on that and its impact on us. On today's show, I'm delighted to have with us talk and exchange Fanny LaFleur. She is a master of science and a social entrepreneur, journalist, and licensed counselor. These combined career areas are the foundation of the expertise and quality professional services that she offers through her company, LaFleur Communications. She has 25 years of professional experience in these various capacities, having graduated from the University of Iowa with a master's degree in educational counseling from the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. She also has a background as an award-winning newspaper reporter, working for a variety of media outlets across many states, and interestingly, has worked in psychology and writing and served as a co-editor, writer of one of the books of the late author M. Scott Peck, M.D., The Road Less Traveled and Beyond. Well, that's certainly really a fascinating series of things to bring together, and we'll be talking about that wonderful blend today more with our guest, Fanny LaFleur. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison.
I have to comment that I have some similar elements of a similar professional background. So, you know, I often find in your writings and your comments and what you reveal and share on Facebook, which is where we first encountered each other, that I really resonate with what you have to say. And I guess it makes sense because I don't know how many of us out there are who share a background in both reporting and journalism and psychological understanding and analysis. I was fascinated to kind of learn more about her background that way. And, you know, what we're going to be kind of taking the pulse of on today's show is the mental health of Americans and the role that is played in kind of shaping our mental health and our attitudes by racism, by the media, and, you know, by a whole range of popular attitudes and understandings that are due for a reexamination and possible rehaul. If listeners could come away from this program, let's say one or two principal takeaways of what they need to do to help us all better navigate the very challenging times that we are in, what would you like them to take away from this, or what kinds of understandings or shifts do you think could be the most helpful both to us as individuals, but also to the greater picture of what's going on in our world today?
Sure. Well, I think it's important for people to recognize that we've been all socialized to be externally focused versus internally aware. And, you know, many professionals in the field of psychology talk about the importance of making that which is unconscious become conscious. I believe that the period we are in now in this country is a challenge and a wake-up call for all of us to take personal responsibility for how we show up in the world, how we interact with other people, and whether or not we model what it means to be conscious and reasonably decent human beings, in terms of recognizing that a lot of the old ideologies that we were socialized to accept as legitimate actually have been a severe disservice to diverse humanity. And so the psychology of racism is an area of expertise that I have really developed over 30 years, and it started, of course, with my own personal awareness and a need to ask questions about things around me that didn't make sense. And as I explored more and attended workshops and participated in encounter groups and focus groups and all kinds of educational events, I started really reading a lot of writers who are not mainstream. And so I personally started to have some real breakthroughs in my own consciousness about how embedded racism is in our thinking, and so much of it we take for granted. And and that doesn't mean that people of color can be racist, but that we can be affected by internalized racism. In order to be racist, one has to be part of a group with the social power to impact the collective opportunities and collective quality of life and resources that other people have access to. So I think we first need to talk about people needing to be clear about the definition of racism. Racism is not the same as prejudice. Prejudice, anybody can be prejudiced, but the key that we need to focus on is systemic racism, where because of how our country operates and because of our history, white people have been the demographic group with the social power to discriminate, oppress, and do harm to other people who are not defined as white. And so racism is essentially an ideological foundation where white superiority is imposed on everyone as a default way of thinking, and it implies that other people should regard themselves as inferior. And actually that is setting people up for all kinds of dysfunction to even buy into it, and yet we've all been socialized, and all the institutions that are part of our society have reinforced the socialization of white supremacy as a default, normalizing whiteness and making everybody else seem odd or on the margins or you know, we certainly know history has many examples of ways in which the oppression of Native Americans and black and brown people has been carried out in the name of white supremacy.
Well,
the point is that I think that we need to move away from simply being externally focused, and more people need to take responsibility to do their own inner work around these issues.
What I'm wondering is, A, how do people do that? And B, most people would not regard themselves as benefiting from racism or as actively racist. Most white people, I mean, what I see a lot is a lot of people kind of standing up in a certain way, maybe a very superficial way, tolerance, inclusion, and all of that. And I think it's maybe hard for some of us as white people to actually acknowledge how we benefit, or to see where this is unconscious in us. And so, you know, what do we look for in order to work on it?
Okay, well, first of all, people need to recognize that they're just not individuals. They're also part of groups and collective entities that, you know, in our society has been defined as demographic groups. And so whether or not a person as an individual views himself or herself as racist, it still does not discount the fact that there's a larger society that operates that we all were born into and have been shaped by, and we've been socialized to accept certain things as normal. And so, you know, we all are those of us who drive, we drive on roads that we didn't build. We go to schools that, you know, were already there when we were born, or certainly we didn't build them. And so if, in fact, we benefit from things that were already established before we were born, why wouldn't we also be affected by cultural practices and ideologies that existed before we were born? So there are three...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're multidimensional as human beings, all of us, regardless of race. Mm-hmm. But there are layers to our experiences that include the individual lived experience as well as our cultural and historical influences and how institutions impact us and how our families and generational experiences also impact us. So, yes, the past does affect the present. And for people to just think of themselves only as individuals is basically a very short-sighted approach. We all are individuals, unique, certainly, but we also are parts of collective and tribal and demographic group classifications, whether we signed up for it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's really, really so. You know, I mean, let's pick an issue that, you know, might be a common issue and sort of unpack it little bit in terms of, you know, and I mean, if you have an issue to suggest, you know, like that would be a good example that we could kind of look through that lens of that issue at how people from different parts of the collective see the issue differently and how we might, you know, as white people learn to have a broader view and deeper understanding of the issue.
Okay. Well, let's talk about psychology and the psychology of racism in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Psychology has to do with the mind and the soul, and obviously that is related to our thought processes, our feelings, and our behaviors, right? So if we look at psychology as one factor and then racism as another, we're talking about how an ideology impacts how we think, feel, and behave. And if we're not conscious of how we've been socialized, then we are basically acting on information that other people embedded in us, and until we become conscious of those beliefs and ideas and thought processes, then we actually tend to just repeat what we've been taught. So obviously white supremacy ideology is focused on promoting the idea that being white makes people inherently superior, and on the face of it, a lot of people accept that as being legitimate, but don't go deeper to really think about what that implies. So As a result, there's a lot of people who are operating from assumptions that are based on primitive thinking, religiosity, economic motivations, biased scientific premises from history that were carried across generations. There's so many factors that play into how people think about themselves and other people. So the notion of inherent superiority based on skin color is so so asinine on the face of it, but yet a lot of people behave as if they really believe it, and they don't know how to operate outside of the scope of that ideology, and in fact become perplexed when they're challenged by just that basic assumption. So we have obviously media and stereotypes that have played a role in socializing people to accept the premise of white superiority without question. A lot of it has been enforced through institutions, through religion, images of a white god, for example. So many factors go into play that people take for granted. And they assume that to be true. And so that, I mean, our belief systems are the foundation of how we think, correct?
Yep. Well, I mean, an example is coming to my mind. I actually have two examples that keep coming to my mind as we're talking. One is I was speaking, this happened several years ago, I was speaking to a longtime friend of mine, and somebody who doesn't reside in my city, New York City, and was planning to come, and the purpose was to go into an old neighborhood where 70, 80 years ago, I mean, quite some time ago, this individual's mother had grown up. And so this woman, delving into her own psychological roots, was very interested to go into this neighborhood. And because I'm a New Yorker, we were having a conversation. She's like, oh, this is the street. This is the neighborhood. You know, where is that? Do you know that part of town? And I said, oh, that's the Rockaways, and that's where Superstorm Sandy had a very devastating effect. Many people were, you know, were not able to inhabit their homes. They were temporarily dislocated. Some lost their homes permanently. The government support and FEMA did not really stand up to the plate to address this, and among the people I know, there was a lot of community organizing and support to try to help that neighborhood and the people in it, and many of them joined with the organizing through the crisis and beyond. And this person said to me, who was, you know, originally bringing up the neighborhood, she said, oh, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in knowing what block my mother grew up on. And at the time, I thought, well, you know, I mean, it's natural for somebody who didn't know that part of the world and their mother came from there to want to know that. But somehow also there's a sense that, you know, perhaps as a white person or as a wealthy person or as a person in psychotherapy or who knows what, I'm more entitled. You know, my concerns about that neighborhood, even if they're 80 years old, supersede the recent and current inhabitants of the neighborhood and whatever they may be going through. And, you know, I'm sure I don't need to tell you that there were populations of people of color in that neighborhood currently, but that was of no interest. It was dismissed. It had nothing to do with me, kind of thing. And this is not somebody who I believe would consider that they were racist or a white supremacist if that was brought up to them. So, and yet, I mean, is that an example of the kind of unconsciousness or entitlement that we're not aware of that we might carry?
that and so much more. In fact, there was a really good quote posted by a woman today who talked about the toxic consequences of people believing that they are super important and more important than other people. And I liked what she said about the fact that, and it relates to the whole issue of superiority. When we get into the whole notion of people being presumed superior based on skin color, that is so irrational on the face of it that where do you go from there if you're starting out with a lie, right? So, you know, I can meet anybody, and if I assume that I'm superior to them just because they look different from me, I'm operating from a lot of assumptions that may have no basis in fact at all. And unfortunately, that's how white people have been socialized, to assume that they are superior, in part because they've seen the majority of people in positions of authority, in positions of power, who look like them, but that doesn't translate to making every white person a leader, and yet people take these kind of generalizations and run with them. And so the issues of narcissism and superiority, and if we talk about what narcissism is all about and extend that to racial group narcissism, you can see how it becomes a real problem. Obviously, it doesn't. We're not necessarily saying that people who are into white superiority are all pathological. Some people are socialized and buy into it because that's all they know. And then there are others who might be more on the continuum of a sociopathic type of racist who really lacks empathy and truly believes themselves to be superior, even if evidence exists to the contrary. So what do you do with people who are buying into some ideas about themselves and other people that is basically made up, fictional, a fiction of their imagination versus a reality-based type of objective viewpoint? Like, anybody can say, oh, I am more important, I'm better than, but does that really, that's a very subjective kind of assessment, right?
Right.
And that's what happens with racism, that people have been taught that that is the case, and they operate from that, and it leads to many having an entitlement attitude and becoming offended when they're challenged in their perceptions. And so it really comes down to the mentalities that people walk around with that they might not even be conscious of.
Right. So exactly. I mean, so I guess what I don't know how we get at this in terms of, if you're not conscious of it, let's say, at all. I mean, I would say for myself, for example, I think sometimes I'm conscious of it, and sometimes I'm acting from old programming, and I'm not being conscious. That would just be my own self-observation. But I think, in order to even be and become more conscious of it, it's kind of necessary to notice. That's just a binary option. There could be a lot more than that, but there's just two things. One, I'm in my old programming and I'm unconscious. Two, I'm kind of more aware of it, and I am not acting from that. There could be, I'm aware of it, and I'm still acting from that. I mean, there could be a whole lot of different gradations, you know. So I guess what, but from a lot of the people I know, most people would say, and these are well-intentioned people, you know, they're not people who are outright white supremacists in the generally recognized term. I mean, at least among the people that I would most commonly know, most people would not be, you know, they would regard themselves as tolerant and as inclusive, and they wouldn't be even aware. So, you know, I'm wondering, I mean, I would describe this particular friend with whom I had that conversation as being that way. I'm sure that it never occurred to her that the way she just dismissed the current population as lack and what they were going through as lacking in all interest, while her deeper search into her ancestral psychology was far more important in, you know, inherently somehow, I don't think she would have believed that she was racist in not wanting to see the current population and what they were enduring. I don't think she would believe herself to be so. So how do people then become more aware?
They have to be open to learning. They have to be open to learning. Okay, isn't life about a journey of unfolding experiences and we learn and make adjustments as we go? No.
So no, I get that. But then what is the process? Like, would I say to her as a friend, you may not, like, supposing that conversation were happening today and I was about to have that conversation, would I say to her as a friend, you are maybe not aware of it, but you're dismissing the people of color who reside there right now and something that they're currently living through? Why would you regard your family history as inherently more important? Would I say that then? Is that what kind of would you recommend that we talk to our friends like that as a way of raising awareness if they're not aware of it? Because they, you know, because maybe they aren't.
I think anything can help along those lines, sure, to help people get out of themselves and kind of look at the collective experiences of people based on race and also historical facts. I think a lot of white people are not educated about racial history. White people have been able to get socialized to believe that their individual experience trumps their group experience. And so
that's very true.
So as a result, a lot gets taken for granted. You know, Martin Luther King said that it is an aspect of their sense of superiority that the white people of America believe they have so little to learn. So
okay, that's a
and
amazing.
He further said that it must be frankly said that whites are not putting forth a similar mass effort to re-educate themselves out of their racial ignorance. And he wrote that in his 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here? The bottom line is that white people haven't had racial pain, cultural racial pain, so they haven't had to pay attention as much. If it's said that most people pay attention when they experience pain, then okay, that might be one reason why white people are able to remain oblivious to racial dynamics.
That makes complete sense. You know, I have another example for you. I frequently, you know, I post a lot on Facebook and there's commentary on my Facebook page, but I also, you know, kind of hang out on other people's Facebook pages and read and follow various threads of other people who may live and be in contact with types of personalities that maybe I would not personally befriend. And so, you know, recently with the whole, you know, the recent horrible shooting in Florida and the debate over gun control, I had been on several threads where there was talk of the violence in our society and what you know, kind of is the recipe of ingredients that produces these kinds of horrible, violent events. And, you know, there were a number of people who were NRA supporters and, you know, wanted to keep their guns, who were participating in these threads. And normally I wouldn't really have an opportunity to dialogue that much with that particular segment of the population. But in one case, somebody was debating, you know, kind of brave woman stood forth to debate with this one guy. And she said, we need to have laws, you know, or protections around who can buy a gun so that a paranoid or mentally ill person who feels they are in danger, like Zimmerman, the she cited him, the guy that shot Trayvon Martin, so that, you know, he had a history of feeling that he was endangered if a black person was in his neighborhood, even, you know, not a black person carrying a gun, nothing, just a black person in the neighborhood. He had a history. And so from her point of view, that was like a benchmark that should be used to deny this individual access to guns. And in the debate that she had with this other NRA supporter, that man was saying, you know, he wanted feeling endangered, you know, to be honored. If someone feels endangered, if, for, you know, they could, there are many reasons why they could feel endangered, racism, outright paranoia, childhood abuse. I mean, there's like a long list of why somebody might feel endangered without the person that they are identifying as a source of the potential danger to themselves actually being a risk to them. And this guy was basically saying he wasn't interested in any kind of such analysis. He was basically saying, I would not have such an illogical thought. And he regarded the fact that, in his opinion, since he wouldn't have such a thought, that therefore there shouldn't be a law or any kind of, you know, kind of policy that used that as a criteria. And I've seen that repeatedly where people, really usually white men, you know, kind of regard their own feeling about something as the, you know, kind of benchmark of the whole situation without recognizing that other people might act differently, you know, than themselves, that other people maybe couldn't be counted on not to shoot somebody based on groundless paranoia or mental health issues that they themselves possess. You know, it's kind of like the judgment is always based on how I would act, and then the assumption that everyone else must be either how I act or how I believe myself to be acting. And that kind of, I mean, to me, that almost got to the root of, like, how do you get people who take them, I mean, everybody takes themselves as the benchmark, you know, so how do people learn to go past that?
I wouldn't say everybody. I think people who are programmed to see themselves as the benchmark tend to do so, but people who are more conscious of the world around them and that they're not the center of the universe tend to be more flexible in their thinking. So, you know, it comes back to, can people get out of themselves and recognize that other people have different experiences? I'll give an example of chronic pain. There was a time in my life where I didn't understand when people said that they had chronic pain. I had no clue what that was like until I experienced it. And I'm pretty empathic. I'm pretty empathic overall, but yet I thought, oh, well, it'll be manageable. But I got diagnosed with arthritis, and I then had an opportunity to experience a range of symptoms and other things that I had no clue about that people who have chronic pain had described, but I couldn't feel it. I couldn't get into it. I could sympathize or empathize with them to a degree, but until I experienced it firsthand, it was hard for me to really get how it can affect daily functioning for a lot of people. So all I can say is that you know, trying to hear other people. A lot of people really don't listen. People don't hear other people. People believe that other folks are exaggerating, or maybe they can't even imagine somebody having a certain experience. So I mm-hmm. can only imagine if someone is a white person and male, how the self-centeredness is a real barrier to emotional intelligence. It gets in the way of being able to get out of oneself and hear and take seriously what other people say their own experiences are. And the truth of the matter is that, okay, think about this. And, you know, all we have to do is look at what people are taught in schools, what people learn in their churches and communities and their families, and then you know where the gaps are. So most most white people do not get history about other people of color's contributions to this society. They've been able to think that only white people built the country, when in fact that's not true. They've been able to think that only white males are capable of leadership, and that's not true. There's a lot of unlearning that needs to happen, and people have to invest the time to do it. Or if they don't invest, they're going to remain very narrow in their perspective. It's something that it's hard to unlearn stuff. It is much easier to learn stuff from a balanced perspective the first time around, but we're just all becoming more conscious now that, you know, we got social media and internet and more sources for information, more diverse people who are reporting, different perspectives are being put out there, and we didn't have that for a long time in America.
That's true. That's really true. In fact, that's really great. Instead of it being, we're going to not talk about this because we'll get into trouble, we'll hurt someone's feelings, we'll offend someone, instead it's like, okay, you know, this person's talking about it. Let's see what they have to say, and then we learn something from it. I agree with you. I see that as a extremely, positive development. Now this is a kind of, I don't know, a sort of, maybe I shouldn't even bring this up. I think I'll give it a skip. But
okay.
There's also complexity. Well, okay, here goes. Around the time that Black Lives Matter was first beginning and gaining momentum, after the events in Ferguson, it was shortly after that there was a sort of a cry and alarm about the long ago alleged, or I haven't followed it closely, perhaps it's now proven, abusive behavior of toward women of Bill Cosby came to light. Now, at the time that this happened, this was one of, it's actually a kind of precursor to the entire Me Too thing that we have going on currently and recently. And at the time that it happened, I was kind of, I didn't know the truth of it at all, and I can't say right now that I'm an expert on the truth of it either, but I was disturbed at the time that when Black Lives Matter was gaining momentum, suddenly we're hearing about this kind of behavior as allegedly enacted by a very prominent black celebrity. And I just questioned it. It's like, why did it happen to come up now? Why was it brought to the fore now? Was it cooking for the last 3 years, and then this is just a big coincidence? Or, I was troubled by it. And I felt a sense of kind of divided allegiance or something. It was like, if any man does anything, then we as women want to stand in solidarity. On the other hand, I felt personally suspicious. Why this man, after so many years, is singled out, and I was concerned that it would interrupt the energy of Black Lives Matter moving forward. Now,
But why should one incident or one event or one example related to a black person individually be enough reason to derail an entire movement? The problem is that white supremacy operates on many levels in multiple ways. One of the patterns I see a lot on social media is a tendency of often liberal white people to post black people as poster boys and girls of bad behavior when there are so many examples of white people they can choose to single out for citing, whether it's for domestic violence or sexual assault. But that I see that a lot. And so when we talk about white supremacy, it's not always just those with the tiki torches. A lot of white people who are, it's not just the Nazis with the tiki torches. We're talking about everyday white people who will resort to stereotypes and default to offering up a black person as a negative example of whatever particular issue, when there are so many examples of white people who have failed and are imperfect and who are whose character is questionable. And so the problem is that, you know, that's an example of white people trying to reset the default to whiteness as innocent and whiteness as above reproach. And so there are a lot of ways, subtle and blatant, that white people every day engage in racist behaviors that they may not even be conscious of, and sometimes they are conscious of it, but they have a invested interest in maintaining the status quo because they want to feel entitled to special treatment. And it's a multi-layered thing, and, you know, people have to be willing to put the time and effort in. It's similar to if you want to learn a skill, you have to invest time and effort into that. And that's I don't know how else people are going to get deprogrammed. They have to consciously put time and effort into unlearning a lot of the BS that they bought into.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah,
no,
these are patterns. There's always been, there's a history of white backlash every time there's perceived black progress, and it's been a cyclical thing throughout history. There's many examples. A lot of books are out there. There's no reason people, there's no excuse for people to be ignorant unless they want to be. And I'll be honest with you, as a black person individually, I tend to not get into long discussions with white people on a individual level unless I'm doing it from a paid consultation arrangement, because I don't make it my job to try to convince white people of anything. I share, and I will talk to people who want to grow, but I don't feel like I need to jump through hoops and waste time and energy trying to make white people better humans and better by getting over racism. That's something, it's a personal choice. If people choose that they want to be jerks and not decent, that's on them. I just know that I not, react to people who come at me a certain way. I just don't think it's the job of black and brown people to try to make black or white people treat us better, because if someone, whoever it is, if someone treats me a certain way, believe me, I'm going to give them consequences directly in certain ways that will make them know that I'm giving them back whatever negative behavior they're trying to impose on me. It doesn't mean I have to be physically confrontational. It just means that I have my own tools for self-care and for not allowing the infiltration of racist ideology to make my day a horrible day because someone else is, projecting their negativity toward me.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds perfectly, I mean, that's good. I mean, so but the implication for, like, me as a white person, for example, is that's kind of our job, you know, to try, if, I mean, if we want it to be our job, it's our job to kind of work on ourselves. It's our job to maybe try to bring each other along, because, you know, otherwise there's kind of this mass of humans, you know, each living, you know, feeling that the world kind of revolves around them and not looking at the collective impact of what we all go along with or buy into, or, you know, so this is an area of growth that we can choose to undertake, you know, if we have begun to perceive how wrong it is. And it's our
But not just that it's wrong, but it has real life impact. So, in other words, mm-hmm. here's the deal. You know, racism is a systemic issue that is also practiced on individual levels, right? So, mm-hmm. actions have reactions, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, everything that has happened is there's a reaction often to whatever happens. So I think that one of the things that white people need to take a look at is the realization that racism is a form of abuse. It's violent toward other people because it basically mm-hmm. results in attempts to dehumanize and devalue other people to the point of blocking them from access to resources that they have every right to have access to. So mm-hmm. if someone is trying to kill you, are you going to always be very patient in how you respond to them? No, you're going to say, get the off of my neck, you know? And I think that mm-hmm. has happened, that over generations, the accumulation of pain among people of color has reached a point where people are worn out, tired. They've been beat down. They don't feel like, you know, a lot of people are feeling like, at this point, you know, I need to just put it out there because I'm not going to sugarcoat this anymore. So whether white people are ready for it or not, there's like this systemic factor that is in play where there are direct consequences for everything that happens, and then there are unanticipated outcomes, and those things also affect other people because we are a collective as human beings who are interdependent, and we do live in a diverse society. And so what affects one population will also most likely affect others. And so mm-hmm. if there are racist policies put into place, such as the war on drugs, and if white people are not held accountable, then that kind of loosens things up so that people can think, oh, I'm superhuman, this won't affect me. Well, obviously that's not true because there are basic laws of nature that happen whether or not we deal in reality or not. So, you know, we have the opioid crisis with white people, and there's despair and poverty as well that has impacted white people as an outgrowth of the racist policies that were implemented to keep black and brown people down. And so it's like a blob. I don't know what your age range is, but back in the 70s, there were these horror movies called The Blob. And The Blob would be like this big a gooey type of creature that would kind of kill or absorb everything in its path. And so it would just kind of suck up houses, suck up people along the way. It was insatiable. It was greedy. It was non-thinking. It was unconscious. It had no conscience. And that's what systems like racism are like. And so what we've seen over this historical period is how everything that was meant to do harm to black and brown people has in some ways ultimately been like a blob that eventually impact white people. And so white people have not been able to really look at how they are affected by systems that do harm to other folks. And I think that's becoming more clear now with the current administration, where obviously the socioeconomic disparities are impacting diverse populations in ways that have created despair and early death and health crisis for a lot of communities, rural and urban.
In other words, the proof of our interconnection is now, what you're saying is it's now becoming more visible despite this kind of false sense of entitlement and immunity on the white side that has allowed this whole situation to perpetuate itself and get worse while, you know, we have trod a lot along thinking, you know, we're okay and always will be. And in fact, this is, you know, boomeranging on all of us now. And that is a big wake-up call and pain point, as you described earlier in the show. So in a sense, you know, that really has to be looked at. I agree with you. I think that is, the likely outcome and the task before us. We're kind of nearing the end of our time here on Connect the Dots. It has been, you know, wonderful to have you here, and perhaps you can come back again and we'll talk more. It's just been terrific, although I know you're very busy with all the people you advise and everything, but it's just been, you know, an honor to have you here, Fanny LaFleur, our guest today on Connect the Dots. And can you let our listeners know where they can find you if they wish to connect for any reason?
Sure. The best way would be to go through Facebook and just find my name and send a message, or and also for people to be aware that I developed and facilitate healing from racism webinars that address historical and present day issues in a way that is life-affirming, so that we can move away from blame and shame, because we all inherited this, you know? We didn't create this. We modern Americans are the ones who need to figure out what do we do about this, because it certainly is hurting everybody to participate in systems of oppression that hurt the society and hurt individuals, families, and communities.
Definitely. That's great. So actually, that's a way for people to raise their own awareness and participate in these shifts in a constructive way through these workshops. Thank you again, Fanny LaFleur, for being with me today on Connect the Dots. And thank you, listeners. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep marching forward, everyone. Be well.
Well.